The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart. The financial crisis brought many of Britain's high street banks into public ownership and left many of Wall Street's biggest names in ruins. Bankers who thought they'd created new financial instruments which would all but eliminate risk were proved spectacularly wrong. 5 years on, with governments still struggling under the weight of the debts they were forced to take on from the banks, profits are returning in the city, and with them, the notorious bumper bonuses. The day of reckoning for bankers may have been postponed, but have lessons been learned? Anat Admati, a Stanford economist, doubts that they have, and her new book, The Banker's New Clothes, is a searing critique of the industry's recent history. And Anat joins me now.
So what do you mean by that phrase? What are these? Are these new clothes that the bankers are?
But the banker's new clothes refers to a collection of claims that are often heard in the debate on financial regulation and banking regulation that happen to be flawed, misleading, starting from completely nonsensical and false to kind of the more subtle ones that are just mythical and just people say them, but when you look more closely, they are not. Something's wrong with them.
And you suggest, don't you, that we've heard a lot since the start of the crisis about how different banks are from other kinds of businesses. But one of your suggestions is that we should look at them in the same way and analyse them in the same way as any other business, isn't it?
Yes, quite so. I think there's a lot of mystique about banks, and it's part of the reason people often don't suspend all judgment when coming into the world of banking, as if all the rules that apply to everybody else just stop working, and we can't use sort of the same common sense. So if we look into some of the things that banks do or some of the ways in which they fund what they do, they get money for what they do, they play in the same markets as everybody else. The people who give them money, yes, they include special people like depositors, but beyond that, it's pretty much
the same shareholders
about the same markets and about making investments. Everybody does that, and some of what they do, other people do too. Some of what they do, they are special in doing, but maybe they don't want to do that, and we have to ask why. For example, we want them to make loans, we want to make business loans, and then when they don't and they threaten not to, we have to wonder why they don't do it. If there's money to be made in those, maybe why do they choose other things to do, or what's going on? So we have to apply the same questions that we would ask about some other businesses. Why do they fund the way they fund their investments, and what is it that they do?
And they're very heavily reliant on borrowing, aren't they, banks? This is something that a lot of us didn't realise until we looked at the Lehman Brothers and these other banks that had a horrendous time in the crisis. They're incredibly reliant on borrowing, aren't they? And that's a problem.
In fact, this is what's amazing when you look into banks in the context of the rest of the economy. The banks themselves would be reluctant to lend to or deal with businesses or corporations that borrow as much as they do. And so you wonder why it is that of the companies, banks that we actually care more that they'd be safe, they end up being the most highly indebted by far of everybody else in the economy. And you stop and think, well, why is that? And the answer that you end up getting is precisely the following. It's because they want to and because they get away with it. That's why. There's nothing to recommend it, nothing necessary about it, nothing useful about it, nothing efficient about it. Everything about it is wrong. The levels that they were talking about, with so much indebtedness and so much of the funding coming from making promises, from making debt promises, that everybody seems to accept the way it is without wondering the obvious thing. Why do they have to borrow as much as they do?
You believe that banks should be forced to rely more on raising money from shareholders in the way that other companies do?
Yes, exactly. In the rest of the economy, it is rare to find any healthy company or corporation or business that relies on a regular basis on less than 25-30% of owner's money or shareholders' money that's not been borrowed. This can be their retained profits that they make that they don't actually are not promising anybody for, or their original shareholders or new shareholders that they sell their shares to, like other companies do. Retained earnings are this biggest source of funding for corporations routinely. without needing to go to other investors to either borrow or to banks to borrow or to issue new shares. And that's how a lot of businesses grow and thrive, is because they make money and they reinvest it in the. Why can't bank do that? Instead, they want to pay out and not shrink, borrow instead of replacing good equity money with promises.
So instead of paying money out to shareholders as dividends, they should be forced to hang on to this money and use it to reinforce their balance sheets.
Anything. They can lend it, for example. They can put it so that it backs up their liabilities, so their promises, their deposits, everything else that they promised, so that when there is a downturn, they can continue to lend and they don't need any support then.
Now, the argument we always hear, and indeed from politicians, including the Chancellor George Osborne, is that if we force banks to raise more capital quite quickly, there's a real economic risk. They'll stop lending or they'll cut back on loans. Now, this is something that you discussed quite extensively in the book.
That makes no sense, because this is a source of funding that they can lend. So we're forcing them to conserve their cash, in other words, instead of paying it out, and then instead invest it. So we're telling them, go invest it, do something with it, and raise more equity, if you're a viable business, in fact, from markets at appropriate prices. Maybe you won't like these prices, but that's just tough. And then use it to invest profitably, including for lending.
And to the banks that say, we can't possibly raise more equity, it's impossible, the markets won't wear it, what's the answer to that?
The answer to that is, why is that? Why can't you raise equity? Why is it that every company that needs to survive in this world, that has a business, must actually either use its own money or go to investors to get money, and nobody would lend to it if it got highly indebted? It has to tell investors that it has a viable business at 20 or 30% equity, and often with much more. In the U.S., it's common for many corporations to not borrow at all, hardly at all, and they thrive. Warren Buffett, a very successful investor, never pays dividends. He just keeps investing the money, and he wants investors to trust him. So our bank's saying that we can't trust him to invest equity money, and they can't convince investors. If so, then we have to wonder about whether they are too opaque, people are too scared of them. What's wrong with their business? In other words, let's worry about them actually doing what other businesses do, which is find profitable investments to make, convincing investors that they have those, and showing them what they've got and where the risks are, so that investors feel comfortable investing in them.
And what's the role here of the idea that banks know and their shareholders know that if everything goes wrong, the state will bail them out? There are politicians who believe we fixed that problem. Have we fixed the problem of banks being too big to fail? Where does that fit in?
We did not. And in fact, that's part of what feeds and enables the banks to borrow as much as they do. That's how the creditors agree to give them money under terms that other people on their own couldn't get. So the mystery is solved. If you want to understand why they do what they do, is because it works for them. How they're able to get away with it is because the creditors agree to give them money under all kinds of terms, under terms that they are insured deposits. That's part of their money they owe to depositors. The people in Cyprus found that out. And in other ways, they give them collaterals. Maybe they tell them, okay, take away this asset, and if I don't pay you, you walk away with it. All kinds of other ways in which people think that their creditors, the people who lend to them, agree to give them money under terms that seem okay to them relative to retaining their profits. Other companies don't behave like that. So it's because the creditors of the banks are so nice to them, because everybody believes that they'll be paid, or most likely will be paid, that it's going to be very hard for them to ever lose, despite all the debt and all the risk.
And what about the changes that have been made since the crisis? You know, the Basel III capital requirements, which are meant to strengthen banks' balance sheets, the living wills, as they're called, which show how big banks would sort of take themselves apart if they were on the brink of collapse. Could a Chancellor of the Exchequer in this country, if a large bank was going bust, could he say, it's all right, you know, go ahead, you collapse, it's not a problem?
Well, the question is, if they did that, would that work out for the rest of us? That's the question. The problem is the collateral damage. It's not even a question of who pays for what. It's a question of whether we want to go down a path and whether we have to. So what I'm saying is, why are we putting ourselves at the edge of the cliff? Why are we allowing an analogy of trucks driving so fast? Why don't we have reasonable ways, instead of putting ambulances by the roadside, putting speed limits on And that's basically the analogy of what we're talking about. We're talking about prevention that's quite doable. We're talking about moving downside risk back to where the upside is, which is to the managers and to the owners of the banks, who are presumably, for the most part, investors like you and I who have diversified pensions that invests a little bit in banks and in lots of other companies. And as a whole, we lost from all this system. So how did that work out? The bottom line on the system is it works for very few people. And it harms many, many others. It's not working.
And to regulators, you would say capital levels on, or the levels of shareholder equity on banks' balance sheet should be much, much higher?
Much, much higher. The levels of Basel are outrageously low, basically. We're talking about 3% of the total, and then they have their measurements of what they are going to ignore, like Greek debt in Cyprus they ignored. That was as good as cash. And so lots of banks in the crisis failed on things that the regulation viewed as perfectly safe. And it's like, oops, these AAA securities, oops. They ended up failing banks. So these regulations try to put science on risk and, in fact, are distorting the system even more. But in any case, the levels are, it was Martin Wolf that said the best line about them. They always tell you how they are so much tougher than before, how we're so much better than before. Why is that the benchmark? Isn't the benchmark where we can be and where we should be? And what would be safe? Just because, so Martin Wolf's line was tripling almost nothing. If they say tripling is
still
so tough, doesn't
nothing.
Give you, it's still zero times.
So
it was so ridiculously low before, and it failed so miserably before, that why is tripling it getting anywhere?
So if the Basel Agreement, which is the international agreement between regulators about how banks should fund themselves, if that says that they can get away with having just 3% or 4% of their balance sheet funded by shareholders mm-hmm. instead of by debt, what sort of level are you talking about? Something radically different to that?
Yes, I'm talking about a level that is both, from the perspective of any other business in the economy, minimal, which is maintaining it between 20 and 30% so that they can absorb losses and continue functioning without needing support. And even levels that banks themselves had before they were enabled by more and more and more supports and safety nets to get to the levels that they have. These are just levels that we got used to and that they tell us we need. But these are not levels that are essential. In fact, banks get too big because they get subsidized through cheap borrowing. If we were to reduce their subsidies by bringing their funding costs to the appropriate economic costs that everybody else faces, then we would see how big they should be and what kind of part of the economy they can be, so they can support the economy instead of endangering us and distorting the economy and taking even the smart people away from other industries.
And they would be smaller, you think? We wouldn't see these giant cross-border banks.
Well, they would have fewer ability to use the cheap funding to grow and become inefficient in so growing. And so when they have all these profits, part of it is due to subsidies. And maybe they'll break up on their own on the force of the markets, just like conglomerates did in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And then we will have them smaller and more nimble and more functional. Right now, they don't have incentive to break up because it's so beneficial to be big and they get such great terms mm-hmm. living like that. But this is exactly what we need to actually contain because they grow and grow and they can really take down economies with them as they do that. So as they become so successful, they can actually be quite harmful.
And how is it, do you think, that politicians have bought all these arguments, have been convinced by these sort of bankers' new clothes arguments for all these years? How is it that politicians and regulators and central bankers seem to have been so mesmerized by these giant banks?
There is some entrenched, there's a mystique of banking, as I said, and somehow people suspend judgment. And then they've developed all these narratives about banking that one seems to never question, sort of accepts them. And some people may not understand. I've heard too many times that, you know, various people who I really thought should understand even don't understand, and some people actually don't have the background to understand. And then, mm-hmm. you know, they get confused even by the words that they use. I'm very glad you never use the word hold or set aside capital, because that's what among the non-starter nonsense, mm-hmm. which people don't even know what that we're even discussing indebtedness. They think that we're discussing some cash reserves that are set aside, and that is a completely different debate and a completely different set of trade-offs mm-hmm. than what we're talking about. We're talking about money invested, just not borrowed. Mm-hmm. which is common in the rest of the economy, and banks have profits that they just choose to pay out and keep borrowing instead of becoming safer. They just choose to live like that. Mm-hmm. And we enable them and even subsidize them, perversely and paradoxically, mm-hmm. to sort of pollute the system with this high indebtedness. Mm-hmm. So it's a kind of a crazy system where we forgot that while making something cheaper for them, we ourselves get to suffer the expense of having such a terrible system, mm-hmm. of paying for the subsidies and then cleaning up when the things don't work out.
And the debate in the US on this has got quite spicy recently, hasn't it?
Yes, yes. We fortunately, because it's not a crisis right now, this is the time to discuss it. And in the election, it was not discussed, unfortunately, at all. But right now, there have been a few incidents that have brought this on. I'm not going to take credit for it, but I happen to be there to have something to say about it. One was a statement by our attorney general that he is concerned with prosecuting banks or bankers lest the economy will be harmed. In the
idea
US,
was that they were too big to jail. That was the phrase everybody used.
Too big to prosecute.
It?
In the US, this is a line that no party is going to, every politician that pushes everybody's button above the law
is extraordinary statement. Is
the line. Mm-hmm. Something's wrong with that. Mm-hmm. And so that was one of them. And the other is we have a few senators in particular and a couple of regulators who push on this, and a few other people who keep pushing. And so at some point then, for example, Ben Bernanke was asked in a news conference whether we have a problem. This is something that the Fed has denied or just not looked there to kind of ever admit that there's a problem. They're always saying, oh, everything's better now. We ran some stress tests. You know that the Cyprus banks also passed stress tests a few months before they really went under.
Indeed.
So we're supposed to believe that these tests and all these science is supporting us in order to satisfy some benchmarks that are too low anyway. And so finally he said, oh, yes, we do have a problem. People are beginning to ask a little more questions, and that's good. Also, we had the London Whale. In that case,
that was the losses at J.P. Morgan's London office, extraordinary losses.
They were poo-pooing that we got plenty of money, we can absorb that, look at us. However, the really damaging part came with the Carl Levin report, one of the reports of the Committee on Investigations, which showed a complete lack of controls in the bank and a failure of regulators to really pursue what was going on, and a number of other things, including, for example, that some of the emails that were going around were specifically designed to evade the regulation, the same risk weights that are, you know, going to determine how much equity the bank should have. They were going to play with them, optimize over them. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that's really wrong with the Basel framework, is that there is so much discretion over these models, and there are, anyway, so many flaws that we don't have time to discuss. But a flawed system that we didn't learn the lesson.
And the idea would be if you had a much simpler rule, it's harder for the banks to game the system.
Well, they'll try to game anything, but I want to stay safe so that all the different mishaps that can happen, all the terrible trading accidents and all the known unknowns and all the different risk and interest rate changes and all these things that can happen are able to still not bring them down. Just make them more resilient, and therefore when they deal with one another, which they do a lot, they're not as risky to the rest of the system. We're losing that contagion effect because everybody trusts each other more. So there's lots and lots of ways in which, as we explain in the book, the entire system becomes better and safer when you strengthen them by this simple measure that doesn't even tell them what to do and what to invest in. Does not structural risk, ring fencing, break them up. It's just a fix of their funding mix to make it healthier and safer.
And have you looked at the proposed reforms in the UK at all? I don't know how closely you've looked at that, but the Vickers reforms, for example, which are exactly that. The idea is that you separate the retail banking operations of these large conglomerates from what's perceived as riskier, the investment banking bit, so that a chancellor could say, well, your investment bank's in trouble, that's fine, let it go, as long as this nice, safe high street bit is protected. Is that a solution, do you think?
The problem is, a concern is actually that are you sure that these outside the ring fence entities are not going to have collateral damage when they default? Lehman Brothers was not would not have been one of your safe banks. Mm-hmm. And its failure was a little bit disruptive, let's say.
Just a bit.
And so here was an investment bank. Here was AIG needing bailouts. They don't come with that label, and they're not necessarily deposit-taking institutions. So this notion of systemic, meaning that we have stark choices when they get in trouble. Mm. This notion is not limited to a particular activity or particular type of bank. This can happen in various places in the system. Mm. So there, if I was to separate banks and create different types of institutions, one advantage of that is that maybe, you know, resolution cross-border might be a little bit easier, maybe, but mostly for me, it's about potentially setting the regulation a little bit differently for different types of firm, maybe. And that could be an advantage. Mm-hmm. Of course, we want them to simplify, but again, I prefer for it to happen in a more natural way by reducing the subsidies first and foremost, because by so doing, your only good things happen. It's hard to think of bad things. We're correcting distortions. If the costs go up, they go up to maybe appropriate level. Because maybe they're too low right now. So what does
that
mean?
But you let the market do it. You let the market decide the right size for these.
I'm correcting a distortion. I'm correcting a mispricing of various things. Mm. And when you misprice, when you have something too cheap, people demand too much of it, for example. So we don't know how big banks should be or how much they should produce liquidity or this or that, because maybe the price is not right. Yeah.
Because the state is always standing in the background. One final question. How much of a problem do you think it is, in public terms, that we haven't seen bankers called to account, put on trial, put in prison for what, you know, the catastrophic consequences that we've seen of the crisis since 2007-2008?
We all have the sort of instinctive reaction that something's wrong with that, that there somehow should be accountability. But I'll say the following. These are legal issues about what you can prove and not prove about somebody's intent or what was in a small print of a contract. They can always have their lawyers defend them. And so it's not clearly the solution. Now, I'll also say that whereas mis-selling and fraud might be associated a lot with financial markets, we have them everywhere. You can have snake oil salesmen sell you stem cell, medicines and other things. So we always have that issue about, buyer beware. Mm. Of course, with risk, it's a little maybe more complicated or maybe easier to mis-sell. But in any case, these problems there is maybe a cultural problem. There is a problem of accountability. But fundamentally, what I'm actually proposing, this proposal that they have more equity, puts more liability and responsibility into this system, which currently there are some people, very few people, who benefit from upsides and of risks taken, including excessive risks through borrowing, which magnify the risk, as we explain in the book, and leave downside for other people to deal with. And so by putting more responsibility and more ownership of the decision, upside and downside, you're giving potentially more incentives for risk controls within the banks, for shareholders to kind of worry more about the downside, and for the banks to pay properly for taking the investments that they do with money funded at the market prices. If shareholder governance can work, which it works less and less the more debt there is, because shareholders can be thrown a bone on the upside, even though they themselves have also not done well, which is also why they're weary of banks, but they seem to have enjoyed the good times. For creditors and taxpayers, there wasn't even an upside, just the downside. How fair is that system? I don't think it's very fair.
Hannah Admati, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Anat's book, The Banker's New Clothes, is out now. Politics Weekly is produced by Phil Maynard. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.